echte ervaring.
You are listening to That Digital Show, a business podcast presented by Google Cloud to help organizations innovate and grow value in a digital world. Episode 36, Open Sourcing Google's Organizational DNA. In this episode, we'll take an inside look at how Google thinks about organizational development and operates to drive a continuous culture of creativity and innovation. Hello, everyone. I'm Chris Hood, a digital strategist at Google Cloud. I appreciate you tuning into the show. So please take a moment, share a link with your network, and help us grow our audience. Joining me today is Finn Toner and Bella Bardswell. Welcome, both of you. So happy to have you join me. How are you doing today?
All right. Hey, Chris. Thanks for the intro. I'm doing really well today. I'm about to go on holiday because it's August, so I'm pleased about that.
Hey, Chris. Thanks so much. I'm really excited to be here. Just before the recording, Bella and I were catching up too. We're going on holiday at the same time to the same country. We're not going together.
Well, geez, I might have to join you then. I feel left out here. International travel, it feels like a thing of the future or something. I don't know.
A luxury.
Let's start with sharing a little bit about yourself. And another thing that we do on the show is sharing the last thing you've downloaded. So if there's anything that you've recently watched, downloaded, that you would like to share with the audience, let's go with that.
Okay, so a little bit about me. I'm a digital transformation and value advisor in Google Cloud. My passions, the things that really excite me, are when we get into agility, resilience, and culture, and how that can help organizations. And I believe it's critical to transformation. I think that's the hard bit. And what's the last thing I downloaded? Brené Brown podcast. I think every word that comes out of her mouth could be framed and put on your wall. It's phenomenal, or at least every sentence that comes out. So much wisdom there, and I find it really valuable and inspiring, actually, about how I want to live my life and operate at work.
Thanks, Chris. I sit within our professional services organization. I'm based in London, and in the digital transformation consulting practice, it really focuses on helping some of our largest professional services customers make the most of some of Google's internal practices and helping think through what they can learn, I guess, at the intersection between our technology and the implications for the organization. That's really the space where we play. The last thing that I downloaded and read was the Pessimist's Archive newsletter. It's essentially a look back at headlines about technology that was new a long time ago and contrasting it to some of the headlines that we get today. So I think there was one last week about the photographic mania. When physical photographs first became a thing, there was a lot of people worried that it would drive a sense of narcissism. So it's a lot like the social media critique that we have today. And actually, some of the same concerns have been around for a long time. So I think it's always a refreshing look back at some of the things that we got panicked about a long time ago, which didn't turn out to be, there was no need for us to worry about them.
I think that's an awesome place to start, future looking in terms of how we view the past and how we can sometimes predict the future. Star Trek has been great at this, predicting technologies that are out there. And when you look at Google, you typically think of innovation. You think of a company that is very future forward looking. From your perspective, how does Google think about innovation?
So that's a huge question. So we might have to break that down into a few parts. And I reckon we can fill the whole of this podcast having a good crack at that one. But I think where does it start for Google comes back to what's now quite a famous guiding principle, which they wrote right back when it all started, which is focus on the users and all else will follow. And there's a lot of things that fall out of that. But at its heart is this need to focus on a problem that needs solving, a genuine human need. And from there, you will find value. If you start focusing on that and finding solutions, there's value. Now, of course, there's a viability element to that. You can come up with some crazy ideas that just would be impossible to roll out on any level of scale. But if you shift your focus of your organization away from some of the things that we've seen creep in around efficiency and profit margins and sales targets, and go back to what's our mission? Who's the user that we're trying to solve? And then focus on those problems, use techniques like design thinking, which give you structure around how to go through that process. the ability to come up with innovative, great solutions is almost unlimited. At the heart of Google, it's one of our guiding principles and drives a huge amount of the innovation that happens in the organization.
And Finn, with that, Google obviously has a lot of different types of programs that we leverage internally to help our own organization innovate. But part of this topic is open sourcing that. Is there some of the areas at Google specifically that we could share to help other organizations understand how they can do it?
Yeah, for sure. And Bill, I really like the point that you made, because starting with the principle of focusing on the user, it doesn't imply a single way of focusing on that user. Chris, you're absolutely right. I think there isn't a single silver bullet or a single way of driving innovation. When you look across Google's ecosystem internally, there are multiple different innovation operating models. I guess from a traditional big I innovation, you typically think skunkworks, and you hive off a separate part of the organization which has a mandate just to incubate and explore new ideas. That is, I guess, is akin to some of our acceleration partnerships or Area 120, where there is a dedicated lab for only exploring new innovation ideas. And then I guess at the other end of the scale, you've got more of the little I programs, which encourage innovation, encourage people to explore new ideas and to encourage innovation from everywhere. So an example of that is an annual Bureaucracy Busters program, which is a scaled attempt to capture bureaucracy, red tape, and to drive organization-wide simplification and improvement. But it starts kind of very bottom up. And then you've got a blend of different things in between, through from certain creativity coaches. So internally, there's an organization called the Magic Academy, which really focuses on helping customer-facing teams unlock problems with creativity. So you've got a real blend across that spectrum.
One of the things that I think is really interesting is the way in which organizations take that bit of advice and then they go and create this bit off to the side of their organization, and they give it some cool, funky name, like an innovation hub or the labs or the zone. And they take some of the people that they think are their greatest talent, or maybe they hire in new people or bring in consultants, and they put them all over there. And they've got this organization, which is potentially a large organization. Maybe they don't feel creative enough, agile enough. And then they create off to the side this sexy new exciting bit where it's a real honor to go work there. And that's a challenge, because they're not creating an innovative culture. They're creating an innovative bit in their organization. And you actually end up creating a them and us there. You're creating a sort of tribal element to your organization. And that builds silos, and people over there will do things, and actually people will feel like they're excluded from that, and they'll almost reject it on principle. So you're actually getting a harder job when you've done that, to get people to take on and assume those ways of workings and the output from those organizations. And I think something, you know, Finn just touched on it, Google's designed into how we've created a culture of innovation. Trying to bring people in and sort of dip them in these really awesome practices, give them a sense of ownership, make them feel like they're part of it, buy in, and then send them back into another bit of Google. And Area 120 does exactly the model. You leave your day job for 6 months, you go do it, and then you go back out. And that's a way of just reinforcing and drip feeding the latest and most extreme forms of innovation practice and design thinking into the organization. And I think works really well, particularly when you've got an organization that's perhaps more bigger and slower and more risk averse, doesn't have that acceptance of failure and learning from failure, sort of doesn't want to fail. You can start to mingle in those practices to help break down those issues. And another thing I think that Area 120 do, which I think is really cool, is when you've been into Area 120, there's a sort of social recognition of that. I think you become a fellow, you're given a fellowship. So when you go back into the organization, you're kind of an ambassador for them, but there's this social tag that makes people want to go learn and then want to come back and help spread that innovative culture. And of course, by making it a temporary move, not a permanent, you don't assimilate into that new tribe and go, oh, I'm one of the cool innovative ones now. You go in, you learn with a view to coming back, and that's always the way it's going to be.
One of the consistencies in both of your responses here is people. And I think the successful organizations, especially the way that Google looks at this, is that every single employee has the opportunity to create innovation within that company. If we look at it from a perspective that everyone is responsible for innovation, how does Google help drive some of that where we help to elevate each other to support that innovative culture?
I think one of the ways in which we really try to do that is to encourage diversity. I think there really is internal recognition that when you get a bunch of different perspectives, you're going to have a much better approach to tackling a problem than if everybody's coming at the issue from the same perspective. The second thing that I think, there's an encouragement for people to experiment. And you know that you're never going to do something so wrong so badly that it will blow back at you. And there is a sense of safety in the risk taking that you can take if you're trying something new with a customer. I know that my manager has my back in case that goes wrong. I'm obviously not going to try something incredibly stupid, but I know that I can take that risk to learn and try to improve if it comes from a sensible starting place.
There's a brilliant story it's in Eric Schmidt's book about someone working on something, made a mistake, and it cost $1 million. And afterwards, they had the sort of whole conversation, and this guy was really, really worried. I'm so going to get fired. They had a whole conversation about the mistake, figured out what they needed to change, how they were going to change things in the future. And he was sort of waiting for the, and you can leave your pass at the door on your way out. And there was that moment where he sort of looked at his manager and said, am I okay here? And he's like, ask the group, did we get $1 million of learning from that mistake? And everyone said, yeah, we did. And so it was fine, because that approach of it's not failure, it's learning. You've just got to make sure that you don't fail really slowly, because that's when you start to lose a lot more money. It's about how can we quickly get feedback and quickly learn and quickly iterate, that sort of agility to get the learning in as fast as possible. And I think something that's really, really important to having an environment where it's safe to fail, and Finn, you touched on it there, is this idea of psychological safety. I expect quite a lot of people listening to this conversation may have heard about Project Aristotle, which was a bit of research that Google did back in 2012, I think. And basically the mission of that project was to work out what makes teams great. And they spent a lot of time looking at data, couldn't find any patterns, looked at a load of academic studies, couldn't find any patterns. And it took years to figure out that actually the single most important thing to making teams function well is psychological safety. That knowledge that you can share if you don't think something's okay, you can share an idea and you won't be laughed at, you can fail and it will be okay. If you remove those things, people don't speak up. They're silent. Mistakes go unchanged. Great ideas don't come up because no one can be creative in that situation where you're double guessing yourself all the time about whether to speak up. So it's a term that's bandied around a lot. Oh, yeah, I have a very psychologically safe team. It's really important. And something that I worry about and don't see enough of is people just stopping and checking themselves. Is this environment really safe? And I tell you a really bad way to find out whether your team feels safe, and that's to, in a team meeting, say, hey, everyone feels safe, don't you? I mean, the most ridiculous idea, but that's almost the way I sometimes see it happening. And I think this is where you have to leverage technology, and something, again, that I think Google does well, but a lot of organizations do well, is ask people in a way where they can answer honestly in a safe way, and you get that genuine feedback about, where is your organization on that? Because if you're not doing well on safety, you're throttling your ability to innovate and succeed as an organization. And the famous example in Google is, of course, Google Geist, where we do this annual survey and explore a whole load of different elements of successful organizations and get feedback from every single Googler. And then they really take the results seriously and act on them at all cuts and slices of the organization.
I think the highlight in there is the ability for us to fail fast and having the safety to understand that as part of innovation is to be able to experiment and fail. But I think that starts way before we even sit down to discuss some project we have. I think it actually begins at the hiring process. And the way that we introduce people into the organization, the entire interviewing and onboarding process, I think is critical to attract individuals who are successful at failing and who are successful at encouragement and sharing with each other to create that culture of innovation. Finn, have you ever been a part of the hiring process?
Yes, so Chris, I think one of the mantras that is held dearly internally is that recruitment is one of the most important things that you do. And everyone, once you're in the organization for, I think it's 6 months, you are expected as an individual to proactively contribute to the hiring and the growth of your team. And we're coming up to the end of the performance year and everybody's writing and spending a lot of time on their self-assessments. One thing everybody always does is records how many interviews you were actively involved in. I think Googlers are an incredibly internally competitive bunch, and I guess almost everything is measured. There is a metric you can find about the latency for submitting your feedback to someone in as part of the interview process. People get pretty competitive about that. There is a league table within professional services about the most active and the fastest interviewers, which again helps to, it's a supporting piece of fabric which supports that intent that everybody should be involved in and everybody should take the recruitment process very seriously.
It's hard to recruit, and I put in quotes which no one will be able to see, innovative people. So what we're looking for is traits and characteristics, and we have this three interview process where we try to take different sides of how people operate in the work environment. And something that I think is really interesting about how we do that is that one of the things we look at is an interview called role-related knowledge. And you can fail role-related knowledge and then go apply for another role and we'll absolutely look at you if you passed your googliness interview and general cognitive ability. So we're looking for a person that operates in a certain way, not necessarily for an exact match against a role spec. But if you can't in your interview demonstrate that you operate in a certain kind of way when faced with a problem or a difficult scenario, that will be a showstopper for you. And that's interesting that we put that emphasis on how you operate, not your list of accomplishments. And I actually think that's quite unusual in the industry. And one other thing that I've noticed is there are some phenomenally talented people in the organization, and Google's aiming to hire the best people that are out there. But they're pretty good at not hiring what I call the individual superstars, but hiring people that are motivated and get satisfaction and do their best to help others succeed. So they recognize themselves as part of a team and that the team's success is the outcome, not their own individual glory and bluntly ego. And I'm sure we've all come across that in previous scenarios.
But I think one of the other, I guess the combination of the multiple ways of tackling innovation and tackling a problem combined with the focus, as you said, on the recruitment process and trying to attract certain sorts of people, I think lands us at the point where we're very much not subscribing to the belief that innovation requires only creative individuals and that innovation is as much about the process and the environment rather than just throwing a bunch of geniuses into the mix and waiting for the apple to fall on the head.
Yeah, we've said it before. Innovation can come from anyone. The thought process that innovation is exclusive to a certain type of individual or a certain mindset is completely and totally false. And Bella, this is an area I know you've spent a lot of time in, which is helping organizations make that transition from a traditional business where there typically is a lot of silos to more of a digital business where it's all open. So what are some of the lessons that you've learned in helping organizations make that transition?
So what's something we often hear is make me more like Google. And I think that's totally the wrong place to start. And my reasoning for that is that you want to be the best version of your organization with your people, with your mission, and with your capabilities and your people. For me, it's about where do you want to get to and why do you want to get there? And it really comes down to this why question over and over again. I think often organizations just have this idea that if they were more like Google, everything would be fine. And that's why we want to work with you. It'll just rub off and then magically everything will be great. But actually, you've got to look at Google, but not just Google, actually, a huge amount of organizations and thought leadership, and look at what challenges you're trying to address. And then think, what can I learn from Google that I could apply in my organization with the constraints that I'm operating with the people I have, with the talent I have, that will help me get closer to that goal? So for me, the start point is a series of like a three-year-old child whys. I try not to say it in exactly that way, but actually that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to discover why they're there, where they want to get to and why, and then a bit of the context of where they're at the moment. And then you can start to figure out which bits of my experience from Google and other organizations could help them get there. That's a hard thing to change. Culture takes years to shift. And it's a hard thing to explain as well until you've actually had the opportunity to experience how it feels when you're not in that environment. And I think something we've tried to bake into how we in Google Cloud, how we do business, is to give people a taste of how it feels when we try and set the environment up so that people are safe and you can come up with crazy ideas and people will jump on each other's ideas and it progresses. And the benefit of that diversity of opinions and thoughts coming into the room and equal voice for everyone, trying to remove what I love this, the HIPPO, the highest paid person's opinion, where they speak first and then everyone just shuts up and agrees. Zero innovation. So that approach of trying to bring that feeling to life so that people get why that helps and why that generates great ideas. Then you're in a place where they can see why it matters. You can start helping them prioritize that in their transformation roadmap. And often that's a load of technical implementations and not much culture. But for me, that's an absolutely critical part of that transformation journey.
I'll take the other side of make me more like Google. There's a lot of times where I'll go and talk with a customer, tell them all these wonderful things, and their response is, yeah, but we're not Google. We can't do that. And Finn, maybe you have a perspective on just organizational transformation.
I've got this analogy stuck in my head that organizational change and expecting change to happen is a bit like putting a seed on a lino floor and expecting it to grow. Unless you create the environment and the supporting fabric to land a change, then what you're hoping to happen just isn't going to happen. I know we've touched on some of the things like hiring and kind of bringing in the right fuel, but also I think there's some of the obvious levers you can pull around ensuring people have access to the right learning materials and that everybody is up to speed from a skills perspective. I think there's another big lever about tooling and making sure that it's as easy as possible for people to get the job done. I'm working with a customer at the moment who they have an engineering productivity problem, and it's actually becoming a bit of an attrition problem for them because it's too hard for their best people to make the impact that they want to make. So I'd say tooling is a second kind of obvious lever that you need to make sure that's on the list to tackle, from changing the lino floor to, a seed bed. I think then the third observation I'd make is that really important to try to avoid adding complexity where possible. I guess our natural default is, let's create another forum, or let's add something on top, or let's build something on top of something that already exists. It actually takes more effort, but it makes more impact to simplify or to reduce the complexity. So avoiding complexity where possible. And then I think the last observation I'll make is that when you're thinking through the different levers that can support a transformation, seeking creativity or taking ideas from other high growth industries is maybe an interesting tactic to use. So for example, you can start to get a wee bit more creative with funding models and kind of how budgets are allocated. Going back to the start of the conversation when we talked about an innovation hub, one of the things I've seen work really well is if an innovation hub over-delivers, or if an idea overperforms, then a proportion of the money saved from whatever the idea is gets rooted back into the organization and it becomes its experiment budget. You're kind of tweaking an existing process, but the impact of that, it allows a bit more experimentation, a bit more risk taking, and all within the boundaries of kind of what is allowed. Those are some of the kind of things that I think, some of the basic things that you need to get right, and then some of the other things which are a bit more context specific.
You have to have the right environment. I totally agree. You have to keep things simple. I think there's another piece that I'll add into this. And Bella, this is something I know you understand very well, which is, how do you know if you're being successful?
Measure. Yeah, you get what you measure. It's an overused expression, but it's so true. If you set a target and it's clear and people buy into that, they'll work to achieve it. And in fact, Finn, earlier on, you mentioned that competitiveness about how quickly you get your interview feedback. I mean, that's just a small example of there's a little bit of a number there and there's you're measuring it. So people start just going for it. And actually, what you said, Finn, reminded me when you talked about the seed on the lino, which, by the way, I love. There's this idea of change management where often organizations see any form of major change as a bit like it's a Ferrari. It's like building a Ferrari and it's got all the bits and you put it together and then it works. And then if it's not working, you just have to replace a part. The reality is, as an organization changes, it's much more like a rainforest. You change one thing over here and there's a ripple effect over there. And that changes that over there. And you can't monitor that all the time. It would be ridiculously costly to do so and slow you down. But you do need to be able to sense how things are going. And you need to be aware that it's not like a Ferrari or a motor car. It's a living thing, your organization and the people in it. When I talk about measurement, I talk about it in two ways. The one part is you set objectives and outcomes. You set key results. In Google, we use OKRs a lot that you then measure. And when you measure them, you're open about how you're doing. So there's transparency. When it doesn't look good, you don't just forget about that measure and hide it away. You have a dashboard and you're open about how you're doing. And in Google, our OKRs, everyone's individual OKRs are public. Anyone can go and look at anyone's OKRs and how they did. So there's that accountability right the way through the organization of everyone. This is what I'm setting out to do and this is how I did. And if you didn't do okay, we come back to that safety of maybe I failed, but I learned from it. But there's a second whole dynamic here, which is around sensing how the organization's doing, how people are feeling. And you can't measure that with numbers, but you absolutely can sense that. And you can do that with a whole host of things. So Google Geist, which we touched on earlier, asks questions which give huge amounts of insight to how we're doing. You can just have one-to-ones with people and ask people how they're doing. And then when they give you that, oh, I'm fine, ask them again, really find out how they're doing. And then there are things that I've used on projects like mood marbles, where every morning when you get in, you pick the marble that best represents your mood. And there's smiley face, a medium face and a sad face. And then at the end of the week, you go, it didn't look like it was a good week. Let's talk about that. Or it looked like it was a great week. Let's talk about that. And then let's try and feed that learning back into what we're doing and help ourselves progress. This whole idea of how do you sense and adapt is actually an area of like a huge amount of research at the moment. I think the EU are about to publish a paper that's looking into this to help organizations manage this sort of ecosystem of how their organizations work rather than just this mechanical block that just goes forward and you change one thing and that will definitely be the outcome.
And you mentioned earlier a survey that we do internally here at Google called Google Geist, which is actually part of our people analytics team. And all they do is analyze the data to make decisions for the organization to improve the environment and the opportunities that are in front of all of us. So I think if organizations that are listening right now are wondering how can they get a better grasp on their own organization and make those improvements, they first have to ask their employees. And not just ask them, but understand it, take actions upon it, leverage the data that you get from that to make smart decisions to help grow your business. And I want to bring in some customer examples. Do you happen to have any customers that you've worked with that may be doing this a great way that you'd like to share?
I can give a customer example where they're starting from an interesting place. They have an internal concept, which is called consequence management, which is kind of diametrically the opposite of psychological safety. So it is used almost as a if this action is not complete by this date, you will be consequence managed. The concept made sense when it was first introduced. It has now evolved to be something else. And we're working with them to start to unpick that. And they've got, I think, doing a lot of the right things in terms of measuring and providing forums where engineers can provide that feedback. And Bella, I loved your kind of sensing analogy within the ecosystem. They're doing a lot of that to set up. I think that the fundamental shift has started to say, actually, there's a recognition that a sense of psychological safety within the team is really important. And we're working with them to help them scale that concept through some of the levers that we talked about, like their agile coaching network, and also as part of their broader learning and management development program. So that's a customer who is on the journey. They know where they've got to go. Chris, I think the Google example, the leadership commitment to doing something silly if response rates are really high is a really nice tradition. So seeing some senior leaders wear something daft at the next global all hands because response rates were above 90%, happy days. I think that's a really, really small but very visible thing for leaders to do to make sure that that sensing exercise is a really meaningful one.
Something you said in there is really important as well, which is that where you started and something that was a good thing to do then probably won't be a good thing to do forevermore. By definition, if you're on a transformation journey, you should be changing. And I think then that stopping and just going, that's still the right thing to do. What's the feedback telling us? Perhaps we need to change is really important, and assessing it for where you are now versus where you were.
That's something else that we do very well at Google. Everybody gets a voice. Everybody gets to say what's on their mind. Everybody gets to disagree. Everybody, even from the executive level down, as you mentioned, Finn, gets to answer questions, even hard questions, if the majority of the people want an answer to it. And oftentimes we see in other organizations that flow of communication, that accessibility, and that insight and transparency to the organization is just not there. And I think that's something that everybody who's listening needs to go back and reflect on within their organization to ensure that you have that safety, that flexibility, and that openness to thrive an organization that's centered around innovation and strategy and all of the things we do at Google. Well, thank you, Bella. Thank you, Finn, for joining us today. It's been a real honor having you.
Thanks so much, Chris.
Thank you so much, Chris.
And thanks to all of you who are listening. If you enjoyed this episode, then I invite you to join us again over the next 5 episodes for a complete masterclass series that talks about the open sourcing of Google's organization across many of the topics that we covered here today. So join me next week to start that series. Look forward to having you again. Otherwise, if you have questions, comments, or ideas for the show, connect with us throughout social media. And of course, join us next week on another episode of That Digital Show. Thanks for listening.